right, welcome back, everybody, to Coach to Coach. This is Making Therapy Make Sense with Chuck LeBlanc. We have Autumn Stepanyans here with us today. We met at a training, Narrative Therapy Advanced Training, a couple of months ago now. Was it January, I think?
Yeah.
I can't remember. January, early February. Time goes so fast now. But welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So what I'd like you to do first is just introduce the audience to you, you know, where you're from, what got you into therapy, whatever you want to let us know about in that introduction, and then we'll take it from there.
Perfect. Thank you, Chuck. Well, right now I do private practice at Moss and Fern Counseling in New Westminster in Benton, Surrey. I have two locations there. And I also work part-time for a nonprofit. So with ministry involved families going through separation or divorce. So it's family law separation focused. So do a little bit of both. I've been working in mental health since 2010. So for a long time, first doing case management, mostly in the downtown east side, and then parent support coach through a program in BC. We have a program called Confident Parents Thriving Kids, the behavioral program. So I did that kind of coaching for about 5 years before I decided to go into private practice and really focus on play therapy. So kind of went that spectrum of working with adults, downtown east side kind of addiction to, okay, well, maybe we'll go into the parenting, to working directly with kiddos and parents and family. And that's kind of where I found a spot to thrive, that early kind of stages for everyone. Yeah.
It sounded like quite the road that led you. Like it's almost in hindsight an obvious road to where you are now, but probably at the time it wasn't.
Yeah. If you would have asked me in 2010, you're going to be working with kids, I believe my vulgar mouth at the time would have said something inappropriate along the no lines. I was so young. But like, oh, hell no, that's not going to happen.
Yep, and then it did.
But the way it happened.
Yeah, that makes sense. So primarily now it's with kids in play therapy.
Yeah, that's primarily. And I mean, I think anytime you're talking to a play therapist, it's working with kids, but really it's working with the family unit too. It's working with the parents, right? And supporting them and then working with the kids directly and giving them that space where they can connect and learn. And sometimes it's so helpful to learn from another adult who's not mom or dad or guardians. Yeah,
that makes sense. So before we jump into that, because I'm gonna want to learn more about play therapy because I hear about it a lot and I know very little. I don't work with kids. I'm basically 17 and up, predominantly male, and so it's a much different niche altogether. Yeah. So can you let us know, I know we were talking beforehand that people can generally find you on your website. Can you just walk through your website for us?
Yeah, it's just mossandferncounseling.com. So you can find me in New Westminster. Yeah, Moss and Fern.
Awesome. I got a lot of that. I think we had someone from the East Coast in Nova Scotia, Nicole. That's right. Oak and Cedar Counseling. It's a lot of nature-based therapies, which is neat and makes sense.
Yeah. I do walk and talk. Like I have nature therapy training in my background and a lot of my stuff in my playroom is very nature-based. So it fits. It fits.
Yeah, it works. I think it works really well in counseling. I know that for myself, we do walk and talk therapy when I was first training, like in the practicum. Because I'm like a very energetic guy, I found it like really difficult to just sit in the chair, right, and talk to people. Other than the fact that I was highly interested, which was and added to the hyper focus, which was a lot of fun. But there were several occasions where I was like, you know, once the spring hits, we're gonna start walking because the place I was working at the time had a giant like nature area in the back, secluded.
Nice.
So it was beautiful trails. And then about a week before I was like, let's do this, the pandemic shut us down. And so I've been virtual ever since. So once I get back, that will show up, but I haven't had the pleasure of being able to do it yet.
Oh, yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. And that during the pandemic, it was really nice to be able to do that. And even with some of the older kiddos during the pandemic, it was nice to just go for a walk sometimes in the movement that you can see with that. I don't know if you read a bit about it. Two of my favorite books, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to have the author's names now because it's totally leaving me, but there's a book called A Well-Guarded Mind and another one called The Nature Fix. And both of them, like, they just have a beautiful way of talking about the research in a very articulate but accessible way, and how they compiled it and everything. And again, I know we both connected a little bit because of like nervous system regulation and like thinking about the modern traumatology and that sort of bit. And both of them focus on that and the amount of movement that you can have with your nervous system and with your cortisol levels, and like just 20 to 30 minutes in even an urban park going outside can help with reducing cortisol levels. So you get kind of like a double whammy when you're able to go outside and do therapy in a park. Here you have nature actually helping reduce the stress and helping with that regulation piece for both therapist and client. And sometimes you can get some good work done. At the same time, I mean, you have, and because I live in an urban setting, you have confidentiality and other things that you have to discuss beforehand. And if you're going too far into trauma work, you might take it back into the office that way. So there's some containment, but it's pretty cool. Nature's always there helping us, whether we realize it or not.
That's right. Yeah, nature and movement science is a large part of. It's a large part of like what I talk about, even in, well, my own life, but also in the therapy room itself. Like whether it's talking about exercising, getting out, taking a walk, you know, getting a dog because they make you get outside. Right. It's all, and I think, you know, a large part of that came from studies that I had read, wasn't from those books, so I'm interested in that, about, I forget the practice, you and I talked about it a little bit, I think, narrative therapy, but in Japan, the doctors will prescribe nature walks, and it's translated into forest bathing. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I forget the Japanese name for it, Shinroku or something like that, but forest bathing, which I think is something that I highly suggest to many of my clients, especially with like anxious clients.
Yeah, they have Japan. And I think, I don't want to misquote who else it is right now. But there's a couple places that are catching up for the research. We're seeing a huge surge in nature-based research right now because they're advocating to have like different, not just forest bathing, but sometimes they're very like introspective pieces in parks that they'll put of like going into a place of mindfulness or doing kind of those regulation exercises of what are four things you hear, and but having those posters in the park, so there's different stations you can kind of stop at. So some of the research done in other countries are kind of helping prompt the funding for parks to do that, just like they're prompting urban funding for parks and how to actually transit to bigger parks. But yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I know with the nervous system conversation, I'm forever shocked that we're not taught this stuff in school. Like how this works, like how the nervous system works, what it means, you know, cortisol, adrenaline, emotional, all of it, this whole system. You have to go to therapy to learn about it and then deal with it when it should be taught in schools. And so when you're doing play therapy, like walk me through, how does play therapy tie into that? Because I have very little understanding of how this works.
Yeah. So beautiful, beautiful. My training is a little bit of everything. So I have like intro synergetic play therapy, and that's really focused on like Lisa Dion does it. And it's focused on like Bruce Perry's work and nervous system regulation. So basically you're being the co-regulator in the office for the kiddo until over time, kiddo picks up on own regulation strategies and you kind of tailor it that way. And then, of course, I have nature-based. So we know that some mediums are known to help with regulation a little bit more. So if I have a room that's full of loud plastic toys, it can be really dysregulating at times. So how I organize my playroom and the types of toys that I choose are based a lot on like, okay, how can this be used in regulation? And also, how can it be used in open play? So I don't always have like very specific toys for each things. I do have like some Playmobil because I share an office with another in another room. So it's kind of like her office, a play therapy office, and then I have my own play therapy office. But even with all the Playmobil in the one room where there's like specific characters and things, a lot of the kiddos want to use my wooden peg people and they'll take felts and they'll decorate or they want to paint them because then they get to create their own characters that they're working through. So it's kind of neat that way. And then of course, like narrative therapy kind of goes throughout all of it. That whole person's not the problem and how we externalize, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of all ties together when you're going into the playroom, as much as it sounds like, why are you using all of these trainings? They really fit well together, all of them. But do you want me to walk you through kind of in general what it looks like? Or
yeah, I have a comment and then I'd like that because get a better snapshot. So, you know, because I get asked that a lot with all the trainings that I go to, you know, my philosophy background, like how does this fit? You know, and that comes from, in my opinion, the idea that a lot of people, they're still coming from like a medical model. So like something's broken, we have to fix it. So it has to be very specific, but really we're dealing with a whole person using skills and tools that they needed to at one point, but no longer work. Right. So, cause I deal with adults. So what we're working on is past habits and ways of being that fit at one time, but no longer, right. Even if you're dealing with trauma. And what we're trying to do is to teach regulation to an adult and teach safety to an adult through conversation and however that works.
Yeah.
I mean, there's many other things to it, but we're regulating nervous systems, talking about concepts, worldviews, like the whole nine yards, because you're dealing with the entire person, right? The ecology of a person. But what's interesting here is you're dealing with a kid. So I'm dealing with the other side and talking about what happened when we were kids. And you're dealing, you're in the mixed when it's happening. That is fascinating to me and how that works is a completely different world. So walk me through that a little bit.
Yeah. I should also add that I have expressive therapy training too with that, because as I'm walking you through that, the expressive therapy allows for not just using like paint as a medium, or toys or sand. But she beautifully talked about like, you know, just felting or sewing or things like that can be really, really regulating. And plus you have like this final project, right? So instead of talking, that's kind of exactly what we're doing. And sometimes with the older kiddos, we're talking, but we're also keeping our hands busy. So we might be sewing a stuffy. They're creating their own stuffy. They're learning how to sew for the first time. And often these are kids that are very, very like active and activated a lot, or they withdraw. So for them to be actually present in it and then talking about what they're doing and slowing down, like the amount of co-regulation that just comes from doing this sewing exercise together. And then you can kind of go through the layers that come up through that. Mm-hmm. For younger kids, sometimes it's a really obvious metaphor that they're kind of working on. If they're working with death, they might come in and after, I usually have, like, if we think about it as 10 sessions, I'll have like a 3-session kind of getting to know you, a 4-session kind of working phase, and then a 3 sessions on working on really healthy closure, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're working with separation, loss, you want to have that time to kind of work with it. But yeah, kids going through loss might like right away within those 3 sessions, even sooner, come in and just toss a doll and be like, this one's dead, this one's dead, this one's dead. And like right away, now you're in the play and you're able to kind of work with that narrative of, well, what does that mean? Where are they going? Like, and talk a little bit more, and you can find out what they actually think about death. Mm-hmm. Or if that's something that they're not ready to talk about, but they need to play out a little bit more, you can kind of play it out. And then once you're working towards that closure, if they're still in that play, going through the working phase, your goal is to, how can you nurture a little bit in that play? So if they're still working through that death scene, then maybe we'll get to the point of being able to have a funeral instead of tossing over the shoulder. And then what will that funeral look like? What kind of things do they want at their and what kind of things do we need to nourish that other toy? And it kind of brings it up a little bit more. So it's that indirect, but also a little bit of directive play with it, depending on the topic. But it's definitely working through and play in different ways, right?
Yeah, grief. I mean, grief and death, those are two like extremely heavy. Well, grief, I mean, I talk a lot about grief on this podcast, and grief is like, to me, the most powerful emotion we have.
Yeah.
Dealing with loss is the most powerful orientation we have to go through. And the conversation about death is a deeply existential piece.
Yeah.
So how does that, I mean, you went through some examples, but how does that come up? And is like with kind of the kiddos that you've had, how does that work through and what comes up? I'm having a hard time like wrapping my head and how a kid, especially young, wraps their head around that and then comes out with a story, a meaning, a change.
Yeah. It's going to be different for every kiddo, right? And especially what's developmentally appropriate for them, right? How can we actually talk about it in a way that we don't want to have necessarily those bigger existential questions, unless it's a teenager who's kind of pushing for that. But we want them to make sense and meaning of it in an age appropriate way. So if it's something where grief and loss too, I'm thinking of it in terms of even foster care, right? Of losing your parents. And then what do you do? And sometimes it's because of one death and then the loss of the other. And sometimes you get visitation, sometimes you don't. Sometimes there's grief and loss in just a divorce, right? A separation, especially if one family's moving away. And then there's death, of course, which has its grief and loss. But again, it's going to be very, very age appropriate. Sometimes I'll use books with it to kind of start the topic if it's not coming up in play, but the parents brought the kiddo because they're either not wanting to like go to school, or they're having anxiety, or all of a sudden they're having tantrums and they're hitting other kids or hitting themselves, or these things that come up that externalize it, even though they can't verbalize it. Mm-hmm. And then it's working with the parent. Well, have you talked about this, or the guardian in that case? What's been actually said? What are you legally allowed to say sometimes too, depending on it? And then we can work on, okay, how can we give some answers to the kiddo in an appropriate way? Sometimes it's reading The Invisible String sometimes has like a little bit of connection there of when someone's there and you love them and they go away, how do you connect that love? I will caution, now that I've said The Invisible String, I know it's a really common, a very popular book, and I do use it at times, but it does mention God in it. So then it's sometimes having those conversations, because some of the clients I work with don't believe in God. So either not using that book or having a different conversation around it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I have a book here, which I bought. It might be The Invisible String, now that I think of it. I don't think it is, though. Heart and the Bottle.
Oh, beautiful. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, that's another one about grief. That it's just talking about relationship with a daughter and a father when they're kids, and then the father passes away, and the daughter's trying to figure out what to do with her heart.
I can see, especially with adult clients. Yeah.
The Heart in the Bottle by Olivia Jeffers.
Beautiful. They have another one that I use, but it's longer, that I got from Marie-Josée Dassy, the expressive therapist teacher, but it's City Dog and Country Frog, and it talks about loss in a very indirect way. Mm. This city dog going to the country and like meeting this frog, and like they have a little of a tough start, but then they become friends and the visit, and then eventually the dog goes back and the frog's not there, and then how that kind of works out and everything. But I love that book too. Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah, there can be some very intense and beautiful conversation, but what I'm getting from it is kids are going to work through these complex emotions and situations through the body. They're going to, it's going to be expressive. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, often in very, very different ways. That's why it's so hard for me to pinpoint it. And sometimes it comes through imagery too. Mm. So during the, they might be creating their own images. You might see in like sand play when you first start, just a chaotic, maybe a child wants to dump everything into the sand play, right? Or throw that around. And then hopefully by the end of it, as you kind of work through and work through the different regulation and give them a place to actually allow that, right? To say, okay, within like safety parameters, like, let's work through this. Life is messy. We don't want to hide the messiness. Mm. We want to acknowledge that you're normal for wanting it to be messy during these difficult times, and then work through that. And then you start seeing scenes in the sand that are a lot more jointed. Like you can see kind of the story a lot more out of it, right? Lisa Dion actually has some really good, other than I used like a lot of imagery that I had learned from Marie Jose in expressive therapy. And then when I had taken some Lisa Dion's trainings, she brings in sand regulation tools specifically for the nervous system. So I have like a bucket and baster and like a sieve to work sand through and scoops and stuff like that. So you see a lot of kids self-regulating through that, coming in with a lot of tension, and they'll be drawn to that first before they even get to the imagery. Or sometimes if it's really early on, they might not even get to the imagery. It's a whole time of regulation, and you can even use the metaphors there of emotions getting stuck based on what, or the emotions flowing so quick, mm-hmm. because they'll start mirroring kind of what's going on with them through the sand play. Because here you have an array of tools in front of you. Mm-hmm. So what a kid's drawn to and what they start work through, they're so brilliant. They're usually drawn to exactly what they're working through. Mm-hmm. And you can just see them getting really, really stuck and trying to fill this little baser, but they're emptying it every time, and they're getting frustrated, but they're trying, and you're able to then have that regulation with them, right? And then talk a little bit about it, but through the sand, talking about it through the baser. And yeah, it's kind of neat. Like, kids are genius in what they need to work through, right? They don't have that filter of how to be appropriate, what not to say, how to hide it all like adults do yet. So it's kind of cool how they naturally know.
Yeah, I was going to say that kids are unbelievably honest. I know my daughter's like, I mean, she's going to be eight months old this month. And she, you know, one of the things that I've had an easy time with, and I think that's because I was a therapist going into being a dad, was just that they're very honest creatures, and they're going to tell you what they need. You might misunderstand, but if something's happening, they need something. So slow things down and pay attention. And it's just amazing how honest they are and aware of their own needs, even if they can't symbolize them in a way that is digestible. You know, do you need a soother? Do you need milk? Do you need a hug?
Yeah.
I don't freaking know, but you're going to get them all, and we're going to sort it out.
That's exactly it. And sometimes it's parents projecting too, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's half of working through of how can we as parents regulate, parents or guardians, right? Because there's a clear love for and a care for, and we all, like, you know, working through adults and being a parent yourself, right? We all have our issues. We all have our things on our back, right, that we're working through. And it's easy to project, say, anxiety, right, mm-hmm. or concern or things like that. And then you're almost hypervigilant looking for that anxiety, or looking for those projections of grief, or mm-hmm. or looking for all these things that you're working through on a much deeper, higher level. And then sometimes I'll see kiddos like that where the kiddo's actually okay in some ways. Yeah, they're starting to show signs of anxiety, but the parent's hovering over being like, okay, you didn't do that right. Oh, are you sure about that? Are you? Because the parent's mm-hmm. so worried about like, am I succeeding as a parent? How can I? So that's some of the work is more with the parent of like, yes, this is a crazy ride that we're doing. It's hard. Let's work on our own anxiety. And then let's go back and let's look at the kiddo, right? Mm-hmm. And what's going on. But it's hard. It's hard as a parent.
That's the toughest job in the world. Some things are easy. Most things are like, it's a weird job. I think that's my take now, 8 months in, is it's a weird job. It's very intense. I love every second of it, but it is weird. Just taking this potato and then, you know, nurturing this potato until they become independent, right? And the independence and the desire for independence and expressiveness comes fast. You know, as an example, she just learned how to stand up. And now that's all she wants to do. That's it. So if I'm lying down in the playpen, she's like going to scramble from one end just to try to get up. Right. And if she's not standing up, she gets upset. So then she just stands up and she's fine. And she did the same thing when she learned to sit up and the same thing when she learned how to flip on her belly. It's a funny creature.
Practicing those new skills that, look what I can do. Oh yeah, I can still do it. What am I going to do next? That's
it. Hey, we're working on clapping right now and she'll just clap all the time, which is hilarious. I think the other day we woke up at 3 a.m, you know, time to feed. She just was fussy because the teeth are coming in. So you get it. Give her a bottle and she's wide awake and just clapping. That's it. Just clapping. We knew this is going to go on for an hour, and it did. And then she fell asleep. And it's such a funny thing.
Yeah, that's it just transforms a little. I have a kiddo of my own. She's about to turn 4, but now she's doing that. Like she's learning about music, right? And like a deeper level of like, I can produce this. I can make my own songs. She's got her own little guitar. So that's different genres of music, but yeah, we'll be walking through the house and she'll be singing and doing her own, but it's nonstop right now. Nonstop.
It's awesome. And you know, it really speaks to what you're saying about you know, parents' regulation. Because when you said when you did play therapy, you're doing the whole family, right?
Yeah.
And I mean I deal with the others, just the parents' side. And it really is, now that I'm in it, it is our projections that create that like reverberation tools, and you can see it. Yeah. Right? So for instance, the 3 a.m. clapping, we're obviously tired, right? And we're like in our head, like, fuck, stop clapping. But outside it's also cute as hell. And you're just like, don't stop clapping. So what she reads is like, don't stop clapping. Wow, this is cute, because I'm not going to tell her to stop because she's doing her thing. But you can see how like our stuff can show up here. Like, oh, she's supposed to be sleeping. That's not healthy if you don't sleep. She didn't drink enough. And then now you're throwing your own stuff instead of listening to what her body needs, because she's clearly telling you.
Yeah. And mirror neurons, right?
That's right.
That's exactly what mirror neurons are for, and how kids are supposed to develop. Mm. And just sometimes we get so caught up in our own stuff, right? And as they get older, it's hard. And it's hard, and it's not, parenting is just hard. So sometimes I'm really cautioned with these conversations too, because it's so easy for someone on the other side hearing this to get into the parent blame side. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's all my fault. I know for attachment theory, right? The amount of mom blaming originally with it and stuff. Like I still sometimes with attachment have to regulate myself having those conversations, because we know the importance of it, but how it originally started with, oh, mom, this is all your fault, mm-hmm. right? And the original kind of wording and phrasing with it. So I really want to be cautionary with that of, it's also incredibly normal right?
That's right.
It's mirror neurons, us working through, like everyone's working through their own, right? So it's just how we regulate, how we notice that a little bit more with it. If we're seeing that what we're working on, because we're always working on stuff at different times, but what we're working on showing up in the kiddo, if you really want to then take that step back and be like, okay, is this authentically showing up in my kiddo? Or is this something that maybe mirror neurons are working a little hard right now? Mm-hmm. There's right. a little bit of protection going on. And then maybe if I play with it with myself, is it something that's still going to be authentic in the child? Or is this something that was like a learned behavior that once I adapt, it's not showing up in the child as much, right? Sometimes we have this conversation around ADHD too, because we know there's a genetic part, there's a behavioral part, there's everything. So how much of my life can I organize in a way where there's less projections of how I'm struggling with what I'm doing? And so I'm getting it under, and then what's happening there, right? And sometimes whether or not ADHD is diagnosed or not, you might see a change in the child's behavior because they're also then adapting some of your healthy strategies that you're using now to work on the behaviors you're struggling with. Mm-hmm. So some ways it becomes less about the diagnosis too, in a way of like, okay, well, what are we modeling and how can we model it in a different way? Right.
That's right.
Kids learn so much more through modeling than teaching in a way. Right.
A couple of comments. So one, you know, we're dealing with like parent blame. That's something that comes up a lot in the therapies that I do. They have the conversation like, I'm worried about, you know, what my kids are going through and how am I going to affect my kids? And is it all my fault? And it's, you know, it's a very similar conversation I have with folks about the things they're even going through, you know, because they're looking at it through a medical model lens of fault or fix or broken, when really it's just adaptational responses. Like, exactly. And that's kind of the line we look at, right? So that's a big piece of the puzzle, is it's more, less about blaming, more about understanding what's going on. Because then you can start taking control of your environment. And environment, I know for ADHD, is something I talk about a lot for myself and for everyone else, that I have a lot of that in my practice. It's environmental, right? Yeah. How we change our environment is going to make all the difference in the world as to how it expresses itself as we go.
Yeah.
Oh, you're really quiet again.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Oh, that you're better? Back.
Yeah. Environment with so many different things. Definitely. Right. And again, this is tailored. Like I can think of definitely examples with ADHD, environment and organization there, even with anxiety or grief and loss, like how are we structuring time for the kiddo, and the environment of the kiddo sometimes can be so therapeutic in a way, these little changes of what we're doing in the home environment. Sometimes something as simple as like building a table fort, right? Or a chair fort, can give that privacy time that's needed for processing sometimes away from everything, right? That a kiddo can climb into these little simple games, right? But a change in the environment can be so therapeutic depending on what the kiddo's going through, right? And all the other things happening around them, how they're processing it, right? But yeah.
That's a large part. So when you're working with parents, how do you invite them in? Like, how does that work on your side?
Yeah. So it all starts with the parents. I tend to have my intake be parent only. That way we can have like an authentic conversation about what's going on and not have to worry about how we're managing our language, that it's age appropriate and stuff like that. We can just talk. And then through that intake, we talk, of course, about what's going on, the concerns that they might have, what it looked like before, if there was a part before that they're talking about, and then possibilities for the future that they're going to. And then we look at, you know, strategies that they're working on at home right now, how they might have adapted their parenting. Sometimes we adapt our parenting because we're in the middle of something and we're in that survival mode. And so if it's in survival mode, like steps back to their regular parenting, what they can do. Sometimes it's doing a little bit of working with school counselors or other support systems or things like that. Like, how can we bring in the whole village so that maybe the parent's out of survival mode a little bit more, right? How can we bring in extra supports so they can get back to the parenting that they want to do, that they were doing? And then adapting the parenting further if they need, if something new has popped up in the kiddo and they're working on it, because of course this isn't necessarily all connected to parenting. Sometimes it could be like the loss of a friend at school or things going on with that, anxiety that's popping up in different ways. So looking at like, okay, is there anything that we need to do parenting wise here? And then working on it in session with the kiddo too. But right from the get-go, parents are involved. I tend to structure my play therapy sessions to be 45 minutes. That way I can have like a 15-minute check-in call with parents during the week away from the play therapy session. So they're still a big part of it.
So it's really ecological.
Pop it up on my computer. Sorry, Chuck.
That's okay. It's an ecological approach, very similar to most therapy. Well, the way I think therapy is effective is through an ecological approach. That's something I talk about over and over again on the podcast. But so it's an ecological approach, because I guess so, because you mentioned survival mode. So there's so many factors that can go into that for parents. Way too busy lifestyle, overworked, all kinds of stuff. Then you have to work with everyone involved.
Finances,
yeah.
I don't know about where you're at, but finances and housing can be such a struggle here. Mm-hmm. It's hard. And that's going to complicate anything else that's going on, especially if there's been a loss or anything like that. Like, how can we stabilize as much as we can, right? With that. I found, well, different when I was working in the downtown east side, it was very easy to do like collaborative work. If people had a bunch of different things happening, right? That ecological approach or systems approach, sometimes we say, they had a bunch going on, you could work with all of their different pieces, right? And put it together. When I was working with like parents before, adults before, afterwards, I didn't find, it didn't work as well as it does now in play therapy. And play therapy, especially when you're talking about like people's kids, parents seem to be a lot more willing to be like, yeah, let's have a meeting with the school council. Let's have a meeting with, let's bring it all in. Whereas sometimes there's a little bit of hesitation when it's an adult on their own, right? Like, no, I can do this, but I don't need that. Like, I don't want to, almost like the embarrassment or the guilt that they're not operating in their silo like they should be. Whereas as parents or guardians, like, they're a lot more willing to be like, it's for the kid, I'll do it. And so it's kind of an easier way to bring it back in. But it's funny, part of it's working on that mentality of like, yes, we want to do it for the kid, but yes, we want to do it for ourselves. Like, that's regardless, right. Like, you know, we need a whole team around us, a community, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of stigma behind not being able to take care of your own stuff, which is it's a funny thing to say out loud, especially for me in the male mental health niche, right? Because we love being in a silo and welding ourselves in. Right. Yeah. But you can't, and the longer those conversations go on, those silos are fabricated. We don't do anything by ourselves. It's not how a human being as a social animal works. Right. But that stigma is still very present and it's reinforced in our society. I mean, anybody knows that. I don't have to go into a big rant. Just for our listeners, just go on Instagram and look at a picture of somebody smiling. They're full of shit. Okay, it's just one picture, you know. It's not indicative of their entire life, right? We all know this, and yet we're still kind of stuck in that machine of feeling like we all have to be self-sufficient. But self-sufficient is, it's just taking care of yourself like that in a silo doesn't work, because we're social animals. We need it. But you did say something. I kind of chuckled when you said, you know, with the parents, they'll do it for the kids, but they won't do it for themselves. That comes up so often when we're dealing with clients who are like very stuck and very embarrassed and very right. And I'll always use this indirect negotiation of their own kids. It's like, how does this affect your kid? How would you like that? What would they say about that? How would you help them? How would you help them with this if this comes up in like 14 years when they're 20? And then we can make a plan for their kid, hypothetically, in years to come. And then it starts to make more sense. Like, oh, wait, I can do that for myself now. You know, just using that avenue of care to direct that care towards the self.
That's a beautiful way of doing it. And I get off easy because there's already kids involved usually. So I get to do that, but that's a beautiful way. That's when we think about that interconnection. So when I was in the downtown at Eastside, I did some community garden and got some community gardens going and community kitchen stuff and everything, because I really have a love of permaculture. And permaculture is what got me into kind of like nature therapy and narrative and everything. But you see that connection in nature all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're looking at like, okay, does one tree do really well or does a couple together? Or if you think about how they communicate or the connection of grass, one blade versus a whole lot. So when you're out and you do walk and talk therapy, you have so many beautiful things right around, and based on what the person that you're working with, what they're seeing, what they're drawn to. Some are drawn to flowers, some are trees, some are the sky, but you have all of these natural metaphors that fit with them, where you can bring this up too in another way, like bringing it up with that child metaphor of like future children. You can bring it up in connection to nature. Of like, yeah, let's think about this. Would this be the same beauty that you're appreciating right now if it was just that? Or what does it need to survive in this context? What about if there's rain or wind, or what's going to help it be stronger? So there's so many beautiful examples everywhere of this, right? Like, yeah, interconnectedness.
The ecology of the human being, everything is interconnected, and it's so important to see that. Trouble starts showing up when we start siloing ourselves, but we're not siloing ourselves. We're being told to silo. It's a very different way of looking at it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Just catching that piece can be so helpful. And you're seeing it a lot more in kids these days, especially with like preteens, teens, like it's younger and younger that I need to silo, right? And it's either that that living within the social context at school, right? Where then peers become parents and you're thinking about that, or it's that complete withdrawal of the siloing that you see in adults, but happening at a younger age. And so sometimes it's having these conversations, or not necessarily having the conversations to these extent, but just pointing out, just something as simple as pointing out kind of that natural interconnectedness that happens in nature that might be important to the child, or whatever might be happening in the playroom. But pointing that out a little bit can be enough of a shift for a child to be like, oh yeah, right? And then bringing in kind of the extra support systems and everything. So not necessarily having this big existential talk, but you're visually kind of putting it in there, or they can kind of tangibly feel it or see it, right, in a different way.
Yeah, it's interesting with that interconnectedness and that it's getting younger, because it's getting, I mean, it's exacerbated by the social media problem, which connects us even deeper. Well, just connects us even more, just not on a deeper level. It connects us through judgment as opposed to actual connection, which is a whole rant for another day. Well, great. Well, I appreciate walking down this path. I mean, I learned a lot about play therapy. I knew very little about it, but a lot of people I know do it, just never asked them. But it seems to be really connected with how we express ourselves from the inside out, and how we connect with the tools that we express ourselves with, which I find fascinating. So I appreciate walking down that lane and walking us through what you do. And I love the fact that we ended up in nature over and over again. That is my world, and I love it. That's good. And I appreciate you being on the show. So before we close out here, can you once again say where your website and how to find you?
Excellent. Yeah. And I will say, it's it's inside out, but it's also outside in. We're That's working right. with both at the same time, right? And you know that. Yeah, so you can find me at mossandferncounseling.com. I'm mainly located in New Westminster out in BC, although I do have a Surrey location as well. But I'm full in Surrey, as it happens. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Chuck. It's been a pleasure to just get to chat with you a little bit more other than in our narrative training. That was fun.
Yeah, I think we had, what, a 10-minute group session to meet? 10 to 15 minutes, that was it? Yeah, so it was great to meet you. I'm glad we were able to walk through it, and we'll take it from there. So for everybody listening, obviously this episode will be out this week, tomorrow, Tuesday, the latest. And then the format is changing a little bit for Couch to Couch here. So instead of doing once a week, I'm doing it twice a month. Now that I have the little one, this has become just too busy. Can't do the once a week thing anymore. I'll just be frank. So we're going to go to a twice a month format. And then I'll be inviting guests, therapists, of course, but then I'm also going to be inviting guests on that aren't necessarily therapists. So from different backgrounds, I've got a lot of feedback about that. So I'd like to dive into different pieces of that world. All will be therapy or psychology related. And we're just shaking things up for the next year. All right. Thank you for listening. If you have comments, you know where to reach me, and we'll take it from there.